ready to hear arguments in the case of Rockwood Casualty versus the Director. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Cherilyn Trevaya. I represent Rockwood, which is the insurer for Hidden Splendors, which was the named RO in this Black Lung case. The claimant is Tony Curianos, and the Director has also involved in this case, being that it's an agency decision. In order to have a case before the Black Lung Benefits Act, for the minor to receive benefits, he must be totally disabled due to pneumoconiosis. The responsible party to pay the benefits to a minor who makes that showing is what's known as the responsible operator. And the responsible operator is the party who has last hired the person as a minor for 1 year. Under the DOL regulations, a notice of claim is issued to a potentially liable responsible operator, and they have 30 days to respond. They either accept or reject the designation, and they're given 90 days to put evidence forth, setting forth any reason why they don't think they should be named. In this case, Hidden Splendors was named after the initial notice of claim was sent out because Mr. Curianos' application did not include Hidden Splendor as a mine that he'd worked at. And they issued the notice of claim, and Hidden Splendor originally denied that we were the RO. And you have 30 days to get your response back. All the regulations are worded in such a manner that if you do not respond, all of these things can happen to you. So you have to send in a response. And our response initially said it's not us, and when the 30-day period got closer to the end and we had no evidence to the contrary that Mr. Curianos had worked for us for over a year, we accepted the designation. After the 90-day period ran...
Well, he was your employee. Wouldn't you have some opportunity to know what he did?
In a normal situation, I would agree with you, Your Honor, but as the facts bear out, the mine was not even open. So we're dealing with a closed mine trying to find records, and that is probably why the staff accountant's facts to the DOL, which came after the 90-day
period. How long was the mine closed?
I do not know, Your Honor. It's not part of the record. He basically sent the facts to the district director.
Can I follow up? How does that help you? If the mine was closed, wouldn't that suggest that it would be even easier to determine that the claimant wasn't working underground?
My client did not have that information, Your Honor.
How did the staff accountant obtain it?
When the notice of claim was issued, it was directly issued to Hidden Splendor, and Hidden Splendor issued the response. It didn't go through the insurance company.
Clarify what you mean by the mine was closed? The mine may be closed, but is Hidden Splendor still an operating entity?
Hidden Splendor had purchased the mine. From what I understand, from what Mr. Curianos testified to at the hearing, the mine was originally owned by Murray Energy, and Hidden Splendors wanted to purchase the mine. And the mine, as to whether or not Hidden Splendors could actually purchase the mine, was all in a court to be decided as to whether or not they were going to be allowed to have the mine during the time period that Mr. Curianos worked there. So they did not have a full functioning anything until the court said, yes, you can have the mine, at which time Mr. Curianos no longer was needed as a security guard. With that said, none of that information was apparent while the case was before the district director.
But available and accessible, right?
I'm sorry, ma'am?
Available and accessible. How difficult would it be to know whether or not the mine was operating?
The only reason we found out that the mine was not operating was when Mr. Curianos testified at the hearing. The document that was provided by the staff accountant indicated that he worked at the mine at two separate times before then for Hidden Splendors at a different mine.
You're representing the insurer only, is that right?
We are representing Rockwood, yes.
Okay. And was Rockwood notified of the claim when it was initially filed?
I believe that the insurance companies are supposed to be, but you, without having the certificate of service for the notice of claim in front of me, which would be in the record, I have no idea right off the top of my head.
What do you mean when you say we didn't have access to this information? You're referring to Rockwood, you're referring to Head and Splendor, or are you referring to both?
Well, I represent Rockwood. I mean, obviously, Hidden Splendor had some information because of the staff accountant, who we know did receive the notice of claim, was the one who sent the fax to the DOL after the 90-day time period had run. That document basically confirmed that he worked there for 367 days in the mine, and at the loadout. A loadout signifies it's an open mine.
Well, we're getting a little bit far from my question. Who is responsible for identifying or responding on the issue of responsible operator? Was it Hidden Splendor or was it Rockwood?
It can be either.
Well, who was it here?
In this case, it was Rockwood.
Why is that?
I don't know how they got it. If they were not listed on the certificate of service, then maybe Hidden
Splendor. Who has the burden on this issue of reasonably ascertainable? Is it you?
Well, under the APA, the burden is supposed to be on the claimant for everything, Your Honor. But the way the regulations have been written, the claimant has absolutely no responsibility to show who they worked for. And the DOL has the responsibility of choosing which mine they worked for, and they have pushed the responsibility onto the responsible operators that have been named to provide the information as to whether or not they are the RO.
Well, doesn't that make sense?
Well, the claimant would know where they worked more so than anybody. I don't know why we would transfer a burden over when the burden is supposed to be at all times under the APA with the claimant, and that is a problem with the regulation.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it isn't so much a question of where he worked, it was a question of what he did, right? I mean, there's no dispute that he was there for a year.
That is correct. He worked for Hidden Splendors for 367 days, and that time, that the last period where he was actually a security guard, was not counted as a minor, which means that Hidden Splendor could not be the responsible operator under the regulations. And a lot has been discussed about the stipulation and the withdrawal of a stipulation, and we've had a lot of words saying that it's too late when you get in front of an ALJ. And while the language of 463 says it reasonably as retainable while it's before the district director, at some point a new issue that comes before the ALJ, which this clearly was, none of us expected Mr. Corianos to show up and say, oh, hey, I worked as a security guard. That was not ever in anybody's mind, and we were left with a situation where an ALJ has now found Hidden Splendor to be the RO, even though it couldn't possibly be under the regulations. And we have also set forth to this court in a motion to supplement the record the practice of the solicitor's office and the regional solicitor's office to use agreed orders, which basically say, hey, you're going to agree that you're the RO, and if new testimony comes forward when you're at the ALJ office, you can withdraw the stipulation.
Can I ask you, before you get underway with regard to these other agreed orders, when you say that nobody could have anticipated this and that this was a new issue, a few minutes ago you acknowledged, which I think is factually correct, that Rockwood's first response was that it is not a responsible operator. In other words, it denied that he was a minor as defined for 1 year, and it then affirmatively relinquished that. So is it fair to say that it was a new issue that nobody could have anticipated until the minor testified?
They are routinely denied when the operator responses are filed. They are denied until you can get the Social Security earnings report, which might confirm their employment. And once the Social Security earnings report shows up and shows that he's worked in 2006, 2007, 2010, 2011, the odds are more likely than not that that man is going to have been there for a year, especially when the amount of money that they are paid is taken into consideration and the calculation is done by the ALJ. So it became a new issue because it was not an issue. And everything that was put in front of the district director confirmed that Mr. Corianos was a minor and that Hidden Splendor was the RO. And it was only when he came in and testified to the contrary that we moved to withdraw the stipulation as the RO.
What is it that the staff accountant looked at in order to furnish this information that had not been accessible earlier during that it was before the district director?
We have no idea, Your Honor. It was filed by the staff accountant, and it wasn't even provided to me as counsel for Rockwood additional 80 days after it got filed with the DOL.
Okay, so is it fair to say that you don't know what Rockwood might have known? Rockwood might have known information that, the Hidden Splendor might have known by talking to its own employee that Rockwood might not have known. Is that
fair? It's a fair statement, Your Honor, and that's the problem you get into when you have insurance companies and mines. They used to all be self-insured, but obviously that doesn't happen as much anymore. And in reality, it becomes an issue because you basically have someone who it does not meet the required regulatory definitions.
Well,
the ROE
counsel, I'm a little confused. Maybe it has something to do with the way the process works. But if you have information that the employee worked there for at least a year, but you're not sure because the mine's closed or for whatever reason, you don't have information about exactly what the person did, why enter the stipulation?
It's not because of the way the regulation is worded. The regulation says you have to provide an answer. If it's not answered, then you waive it. So we answer it. We answer it based on what we have at the time.
Can you ask for more time?
If there's a reason to, that you could certainly ask for it. In this case, there was nothing. We had a Social Security earnings report, which is what 99% of these cases are based on. You wait for the Social Security earnings report to show when someone worked for you, and that is how it is decided. We don't ever really have this issue. And if you don't mind, I'd like to save a little time for rebuttal, and I'm at 3 minutes right now. But the other thing I wanted to put forth to this court, because I didn't get to talk about the motionary thing, is the fact that this all becomes a moot point with the fact that Mr. Kourianos is required to be totally disabled due to pneumoconiosis in order to receive benefits. And then in this case, Mr. Kourianos' PFTs were absolutely normal. They improved after 2 years, which is completely contrary to science and medicine, because your PFTs drop every year with age. The ABGs, while they revealed a disabling value before in the DOL table, there was a set of normals that came with the DOL examination data, and those values showed that all of Mr. Kourianos' values were normal.
But and Dr. Gagan testified, did he not, in his deposition and in Exhibit 39, that the drop in the PO2 level at a high altitude was abnormal, correct?
The fact that it dropped at all is what makes it abnormal. The fact that the...
Right.
It doesn't make it abnormal for him not to be able to mine because the value is still normal. Abnormality, it's a term that it's basically... Typically, your PO2 is supposed to go up when you exercise. In this case, Mr. Kourianos has dropped. However, the value it dropped to is still a value which is normal, which means he has fine pulmonary function with regard to that value. And based on the DOL regulations.
Well, I thought that the dispute was over the fact that Price, Utah is at a certain altitude. And the argument was that because of the altitude, it's normal. But Dr. Gagan points out that the way the regulations set the range, at least under the regulations, the blood gas test was abnormal. Isn't that what you're arguing about here?
What I'm arguing about is that when you determine...
When I say you, I mean two sides here.
The regulations set forth requirements for proving total disability. And what is important with regard to those regulations is when you get to the PFTs and the ABGs, it starts with a sentence that says, in the absence of contrary probative evidence. And in this case, if we only had the values from Dr. Gagan's testing with a qualifying value with exercise, and that was all there was, yes, that would be indicative of total disability. But we had contrary probative evidence, and that was provided by Dr. Gagan, who agreed the values were all normal, provided by Dr. Zaldivar and Dr. Selby, who also agreed the values were normal. The problem you get into is that the DOL table is broken down into
counsel,
three.
Judge Bacharach pointed out that Dr. Gagan said at his deposition that there was a drop in the reading from resting to exercise, and that was abnormal. Is that are you saying that the drop, is there contradictory evidence?
The drop in the value was abnormal, but the value itself was actually not. It was within the range of normal. Your PO2 should go up when you exercise. In this case, Mr. Kourianos has dropped, but the value that it dropped to was still within the range of normal at Castleview Hospital. So the problem you get into
Wait. At Castleview, are we back to the altitude argument?
Okay. I mean, the DOL does not have specific, they have it broken into three. Castleview Hospital has its own set of normals for all testing that is performed there. All of the testing
But is Castleview's set of normals consistent with the regulation?
No, but that's why you have
Well,
the language.
That's been my question. Don't
no,
we
but
have
that's
counsel, let me just ask the question. Okay. Don't we have to follow the regulation?
The regulation states that in the absence of contrary probative evidence that would be indicative of total disability. There was contradictive probative evidence, which means no. The DOL has set these standards, and when there is evidence showing that those values are within the range of normal, that they shouldn't be considered total disability. And that is what we have asked this court to look at, is what these regulations actually state. And we put case law in our brief showing that is how those forms of disability are viewed. And I am way over my time, so I will have no rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm William Bush, and I represent the director of the Office of Workers' Compensation Programs at the United States Department of Labor. The director is only addressing the issue of whether Hidden Splendor should have been permitted to withdraw its concession that it was the responsible operator in this case, and I'm going to try to speak for a maximum of 8 minutes so that I can turn the rest of the time over to Ms. Herman, who represents the claimant and has some more to say about the merits of entitlement in this case.
I was puzzled why you only briefed that one issue.
The director doesn't commonly brief the merits of entitlement when the interpretation or application of the regulation itself is not at issue in that case.
So if we're just talking about a battle of evidence between doctors, you don't write about it?
That's a better way of putting it, Your Honor, actually. If the case comes down to on entitlement, a question of whether the ALJ's decision is supported by substantial evidence, we usually stay out of it. Okay. Unless the reason it's not is that he misapplied a regulation or part of the statute.
Thank you.
Allowing Hidden Splendor to withdraw its concession that it is the responsible operator liable for benefits in this case will unjustly shift liability to the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund, and it will set a precedent in future cases for operators to be rewarded when they do not participate in the district director's early claims process in good faith, or even when they fail to maintain basic corporate records about who their employees are and what those employees do during particular periods of time. The regulations in this area set out a clear, fair timeline for operators to contest their designation as a potentially liable operator and to submit evidence relevant to their defenses on whichever aspects of it that they contest. Those deadlines are not a trap for the unwary. They're in the regulations, and they're also in the notice of claim, and they're not inflexible. As the notice of claim points out explicitly, both periods of time are extendable for good cause. We don't know if the mine was open at that time. Might be good cause. Our records are incomplete. Might be good cause. But in this case, Hidden Splendor had an opportunity to look, and as the court pointed out, initially did contest its designation on the exact issue that it continues to contest today or has
revived.
But
counsel said that's just automatic. That's just sort of a cover until they have some opportunity to really discern if this person was employed.
That may be the case. In this case, they sent that. If it's pro forma, then that's what they submitted on that basis. Then they had an opportunity to investigate the particular circumstances of this minor. And about 3.5 weeks later, unsolicited by anybody at the Department of Labor, they submitted an amended response in which they affirmatively conceded wholesale their designation as a potentially liable operator. This regulatory timeline, and I'd add at that point that they continued to concede this issue after the schedule for the submission of additional evidence was issued by the district director, by silence when they responded to the proposed decision and order issued by the district director, when they asked for a hearing and the case goes up to the administrative law judge, they did not identify this as an issue that they wish to contest. And then a final time, in a statement of contested issues to the administrative law judge, when they explicitly stated, we are not contesting our liability as the responsible operator, and they even underlined the word not in that document. This regulatory framework for identifying potentially liable operators, and then from among them, the responsible operator, is extremely important because our regulations also say that once the case leaves the district director's jurisdiction and goes to the Office of Administrative Law Judge, we cannot name another operator. If we got it wrong, the trust fund has to assume liability for benefits. And so the district director relies on things like concessions by parties to cease its own investigation and move on to for the merits of the claimant's title.
Counsel, what would be an example of getting it wrong? I mean, let's say that you have the concession and it moves on to the ALJ, and you say, well, if we got it wrong, then we shift responsibility to the trust fund. Once Mr. Corianos testified before the ALJ, it looks like it was wrong. So what does it mean to get it wrong such that the burden shifts?
Well, we don't think it can be wrong when the responsible operator concedes its designation. I mean, that's a binding concession is our position, and we seek to enforce that concession. In circumstances where they contest initially and maybe submit evidence that would be responsive to that defense, and the district director might interpret it wrongly or ignore it or refuse to believe it, that's a situation in which we might get it wrong.
Well, what happens as here when the claimant testifies and the testimony shows that Hidden Splendor should not be the responsible operator? Could the ALJ then remand back to the director for further consideration of the issue?
Our regulation says that he can't, or he can remand, but not for the naming of another responsible operator. Once it gets to the ALJ, to put it plainly, we're stuck with who we name.
So what you're saying is the ALJ had no options, even in the face of this testimony.
Well, the ALJ could have agreed to allow them to withdraw their stipulation, but by that time it's too late for the district director to name another operator.
But the ALJ could have remanded with a potential for the trust fund to be named as responsible.
That's correct, Your Honor. And then at that point, the district director, fills the shoes of the responsible operator on behalf of the trust fund, would then decide whether to defend the claim or just concede liability, entitlement. I apologize.
May I follow up with one question, and that is sometimes we'll have cases where both sides agree on something. It's a legal issue, and we say, well, we are the arbiters of the law, and so even when the parties agree on something that is, in our view, rightly or wrongly, legally inaccurate, we determine that a stipulation of the law is not binding and contrary to our province, and that's, in fact, I think, what the Navistar case said on behalf of the Sixth Circuit, that what constitutes mining work is a legal issue, and so why shouldn't we determine that, notwithstanding the stipulation, that it is our province as the arbiters of the law to determine whether or not Mr. Corianos was working as a miner for a period of at least 1 year?
Well, in this case, I agree with you, obviously, that the stipulations of law are not effective, are not binding anyway on the parties. In this case, the question of whether or not Mr. Corianos was a miner during a particular period of time isn't really at issue. What's at issue is how long he did that job. And how long he did that job is a question of fact. And that is essentially the underpinnings of what Hidden Splendor conceded in this case. I'd also just like to point out for the court that a couple of times in the briefs and in the argument, we've been talking about the question of whether or not Hidden Splendor could have, as a matter of law, been the responsible operator. That issue is actually not really before the court right now. The administrative law judge made a ruling on whether Hidden Splendor should be permitted to withdraw its stipulation or its concession on that issue. And then in his decision and order, did not make a finding about whether or not Hidden Splendor meets the regulatory test for a responsible operator. It wasn't before him at that point. His finding about the length and nature of Mr. Coriano's employment is limited to the period of time during which he was a security guard. Mr. Coriano's last date of employment as a coal miner was January 21st, 2011, when he worked for Hidden Splendor in a mining capacity. And he did include another portion of his time with Hidden Splendor in his calculation of the miner's coal mine employment. So it's not been decided by anybody that, as a matter of law, he was not working as a coal miner for Hidden Splendor.
Would you agree, though, that the ALJ had the discretion to allow the withdrawal of the stipulation?
We do not actually feel that was something the ALJ could have done due to our notice of claim regulation at 725, 407, and 408. We argued that stipulation is binding. The court has no further questions. I'd like to leave some time for Ms. Herman to address the merits of entitlement.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court.
Good morning.
My name is Victoria Herman. I'm here today on behalf of the respondent, Mr. Tony Curianos, to ask this court to affirm the decision made by Judge Almanza determining Rockwood Casualty to be the responsible operator and the ultimate award of benefits in the case. The employer's arguments today generally are twofold. Obviously, the first, Mr. Bush has covered whether the stipulation was appropriate and binding, making Rockwood the ultimate responsible operator. Employer's second issue is really kind of a more generalized question of, was there substantial evidence regarding Judge Almanza's decisions with regard to his finding of the establishment of disability due to a pulmonary impairment, the invocation of the 15-year presumption, and the question of whether employer was able to rebut the 15-year presumption. As you will see, I think all of these arguments will fail for various reasons. And again, if I can kind of turn to the second argument, I know Mr. Bush kind of covered the first. Employer's argument, again, is that he lacked substantial evidence. Judge Almanza lacked substantial evidence when rendering his opinion on those three sections. I think the big concern that employer brought up is whether the ABG testing and the PFT testing would have established that there was no total disability. The first thing I would note for this court is that there was never a question of whether the PFTs in this case established total disability. They did not. There was no kind of question from the claimant that they did or from any other party. The arterial blood gas obviously is a different kind of situation.
What confused me a little bit was that the ALJ said that the pulmonary tests were equivocal, and that seems factually inaccurate. There was no question that the pulmonary test didn't show pneumoconiosis, I think, as you just acknowledged.
I would tend to agree with that statement. I would say for your honors, though, that would be not something that would be a reversible error in this case. That was not where total disability was found, and I think that statement isn't necessarily something that's going to be indicative of a larger problem. There were two arterial blood gas tests that were performed, one in 2010, one in 2012. The testing in 2012, I think, is the one that is the big issue for the employer. The testing was split into two. There was a resting arterial blood gas, which was not a qualifying test, and then the exercise blood gas test, which did qualify under the regulations. And I think employer's argument here is really that they want the ALJ to be able to make a finding outside of the regulations. The claimant would posit that that's not appropriate.
Well, they're saying, I thought, that yes, yes, the values changed and would indicate that there was a problem, but it was still within the range of normal.
It would be in the range of normal, apparently, for Castleview Hospital, you know, where they determined that that normal range from is not in the record and would be unknown to the claimant. The regulations very specifically already account for the altitude issue that employer is referencing. And if you go back to the regulations, Appendix C, 20 CFR, Section 718, under the regulations, that arterial blood gas test did qualify. He had a qualifying test.
But none of the three doctors, even Dr. Gagon, didn't agree with what the table indicated as normal for post-exercise.
What Dr. Gagon said was that if you look at Castleview Hospital's determination of what would be normal, then yes, that test result would be normal. That doesn't change the fact that it was not normal under the regulations. And I think the bigger concern here is ultimately, again, the ALJ found that, that the ABG testing was equivocal. The determination for total disability came as a result of the medical opinions. And I think the big concerns with Dr. Zaldivar's medical opinion and Dr. Selby's medical opinion, which the ALJ basically had said were both far too vague and generalized to be credited. Even more concerning than that, that Dr. Selby was making statements that were directly contrary to the language of the regulations, that cigarette smoking would, in essence, prevent any issues arising as a result of coal dust exposure and illnesses of that nature, which, again, is completely contradictory to the regulations.
Could I just ask you, the ALJ said that he relied on Dr. Gagon more than the other two doctors because he compared the condition to the job duties as fire boss.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I understand the logic of that up to a point, but isn't it still the case that what really mattered here was the degree of respiratory impairment? And couldn't the other two doctors address that equally well to Dr. Gagon?
Well, they certainly could have done that, but one of the issues in black lung cases specifically is the question of whether with the pulmonary impairment as it stands at that moment in time, the claimant would be able to return to his last coal mine employment.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I'm just wondering, though, whether there's a certain threshold of impairment there has to be before you even get to this comparison with the job requirements.
Well, I think there can be, again, and that's where the regulations come in. We had a qualifying test, but a lot of that relies on the doctor's medical opinions and referencing back to what that employment is. Could they physically go back and do that? Not necessarily that there is a baseline number for everyone to be able to perform a specific job, but could this person with that respiratory impairment that they have specifically go back and do that job? And those jobs vary so wildly, I think, is the bigger concern. If the physicians are unaware of what the job requirements are, it would be really impossible for them to make any type of finding regarding whether he could go back and do that job because they don't know what that job is. And I apologize, Your Honors. I see I'm over time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted. Our next